This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'll be reading again from Wrong Tree, Adventures in Wildlife Biology by Jeff Wilson, published by the Cornerstone Press in Stevens Point in 2022, and beautifully illustrated by his wife Terry Dalton. I'm going to jump backwards in the book. I take liberties. There's a terrific chapter that I don't think should be ignored. They take off on some world travels and do it the way you and I might think is ideal. He calls this the gap year. He writes, "Perhaps my most economically questionable but experientially rich decision was what we called our trip around the world year from June 1995 through 1996. That year my son, Zach, turned 18 and graduated from high school, and we decided he needed a gap year, a year off between high school and college, to travel, see the world, and ideally acquire inspiration and wisdom. Terry, my girlfriend at the time, and I decided we needed a gap year too." And then Wilson goes on to describe the extensive preparations they made, securing the furthering of their jobs, the mortgaging of their house, the financing as economically as possible of the trip. He writes, "To cut expenses, we volunteered on various wildlife projects, which usually provided housing and sometimes food. We joined an organization called Willing Workers on Organic Farms, WWOOF, where we worked on farms part-time in exchange for room and board. We delivered a van across Australia for a rental company, rode on horses, elephants, bamboo rafts, bicycles, helicopters, tuk-tuks, rickshaws, BMOs, a tundra buggy, dugout canoes, ships, boats, buses, and airplanes, and walked through tundra, jungle, mountains, and down riverbeds. We also stayed with friends and relatives and relied on the kindness of strangers. We put the word out to our friends and colleagues that we were looking for projects to dovetail with our travel plans, and the first to come through was Dr. Don Rush, a professor at UW-Madison. I had worked for Don on a rough grouse project in Chatfield, Manitoba, and I had contacted him to see if he knew of anything we could do in the Arctic. At the beginning of Don's career, he had been a biologist for the province of Manitoba and currently had a long-term Canada Goose project based out of Churchill, a small town up on Hudson Bay. Don's research station was called Nestor One, and he didn't have any room for volunteers that season. But about 20 miles away was another research station called Nestor Two, run by Don's good friend and colleague, Dr. Robert Rockwell, Rocky, from New York University and the American Museum of Natural History. Don put us in contact with Rocky, who invited us to join his crew on the tundra for a month studying snow geese. He would provide room and board and transportation from Churchill to Nestor Two. In early June, we packed up and headed for Canada, the first leg of our world trip. We first realized we were really at the ends of the earth when we took the two-day train ride from Thompson, Manitoba, to Churchill. We had already driven 2 days north from Wisconsin, and for hundreds of miles, all we saw were spruce trees, creeks, undeveloped lakes, and bogs. Then we hit Thompson, a kind of jumping-off place for the hinterlands where the road ends. There we boarded a train often referred to as the Polar Bear Express. The train ride was slow as the engine and cars wobbled along, tracks laid over uneven permafrost. The trip took us through the transition zone from the boreal forest to the treeless tundra. As it traversed the landscape, it would periodically stop, and a few mostly indigenous people would leave the train and walk into what looked like wilderness with only a rough trail or ATV track. The hours passed, and finally we started to see ramshackle buildings, and Churchill appeared. After stepping off the train, we met Rocky and some other biologists who had arrived the day before and started the next leg of our journey. We drove to the Churchill Northern Studies Center, a research facility 10 or so miles from town and then began the 20-mile overland trip to Nestor 2 by Tundra buggy. Now, a Tundra buggy is quite the machine. It has 6-foot-tall tires and a cab and truck bed on the back for storing gear. We rode in the cab and bounced along for hours as the driver skillfully maneuvered around boulders, through streams, and up glacial eskers. The flat tundra spread around us, and the sky seemed infinite. Birds flew up from the short Arctic shrubs and water-filled potholes. After several hours, we arrived at Nestor 2, a bit battered from the bumpy ride and ready to stretch our legs. A month later, on the way back, I actually drove the buggy. It reminded me of my tractor days on the Iowa farm, but on steroids. Nestor 2 was a series of Quonset huts connected by rough planking set on the spongy permafrost, a cookhouse, bunkhouse, outhouse, and storage buildings, located just inland from the shore of La Pérouse Bay, part of the huge Hudson Bay lowland. The camp was set along the massed river delta, a series of braided streams and willowed tundra that covered thousands of square miles. It was early June, and everywhere you looked, you could see water, shrubby willows, and permafrost vegetation peeking out from the remaining snowbanks. That first day, it looked cold, damp, and bleak, and the rough buildings seemed muddy and slapdash. Terry was particularly skeptical, as there were only a couple of other females at the camp and a fair amount of ribbing and rough language amongst the wildlife guys. The camp was shared between Rockies wildlife researchers and a botany crew from Canada who seemed a bit less rough around the edges. Once we settled, camp became home in the comforts of hot coffee, cooked stove, and a home-brewed beer at the end of the day were perfect rewards for the hard work, not to mention the amazing ecosystem and species we encountered. While at the camp, we saw whales, Arctic fox, caribou, and birds. Lots of birds. We were smack in the middle of 23,000 pairs of snow geese and saw dozens of other species of Arctic birds, ducks, terns, gulls, raptors, loons, and partridge. There were savannah and tree sparrows, Lapland longspur. We were proud of the additions to the trip bird list we kept. It was nesting season for all, and the willow ptarmigan would land on top of our bunkhouse and wake us each morning with their ridiculous clucking and harrumphing calls. Even though it was light nearly 24 hours a day, somehow the birds knew it was morning. Although it was June in the Arctic, it was early in the season, and we didn't get to see a polar bear. They were still on the ocean ice hunting seals. Nonetheless, we were required to carry a gun for our protection, and our complex was surrounded by a single-strand electric fence to ward them off. There was a trap door in the roof of our bunkhouse, and each morning the first person who wanted to leave the building had to go up and make sure no bears were returning early from the sea ice had broken through the fence in the night. We were a bit nervous about polar bears, and when we heard that a female and a cub arrived at camp the day after we left, we didn't know whether to be glad or disappointed. Our five comrades were botanists, biologists, and graduate students studying the relationships between tundra vegetation and various bird populations. Rocky assigned Zach, Terry, and me 200 snow goose nests each, which we monitored daily. The study sites were a few miles across the tundra, so we struggled across the soggy landscape in hip boots, following compass bearings, because everything on the tundra looked alike. In 1995, we did not have GPS, and we had to follow maps carefully. The landscape was so similar that at first we could hardly see any landmarks. By the end of our month, we had become a bit more attuned and could recognize a particularly tall shrub or deep pool. If you got off course and missed the study site, you had to backtrack and carefully recalibrate, as the small flags we marked each nest with only showed up at close range. At data points, we numbered the nests and recorded egg production, predation, hatch information, and nest and habitat characteristics. We walked miles of tundra each day, leaving camp in the morning and returning exhausted at supper time. Several times we saw tall animals on the horizon. An immediate adrenaline rush was usually followed by relief that it was just a caribou, not a bear. Anything as tall as 3 foot looked huge on that flat, uniform landscape. Rocky's project centered on the impact of lesser snow geese on Canada's fragile Arctic tundra, whose overgrazing was causing potentially permanent damage. The population had steadily grown over the last 2 decades, and the snow geese were crowding out the Canada geese. The botanist crew had built snow goose exclosures to document the difference made by the snow goose's grazing. Inside the exclosure, the vegetation was lush and green and diverse. Outside, it was sparse and patchy and dominated by mosses. The snow geese, it turned out, used their more serrated bills to pull up the vegetation by the roots, killing it. Canada geese, on the other hand, are grazers, merely clipping off the vegetation, which allows it to recover. Rocky's data suggested that changing agriculture practices in the southern United States, where snow geese winter, were affecting the population. In the past, livestock had been let into the grain fields after the harvest to graze, but now many U.S. farmers had moved livestock inside into concentrated animal feeding operations, CAFOs. The unused grain was thus available to the snow geese. This surplus of food for the geese made them so healthy that when they returned to the Arctic, they were able to lay more eggs and hatch more goslings than the habitat could support. They were crowding out the Canada geese whose grazing style was much less destructive to the fragile tundra. Rocky's long-term study documented this, and his answer was longer hunting seasons for snow geese. He even contemplated commercial harvest of snow geese. Now, many states in the U.S. have more liberal bag limits for snow geese, and North and South Dakota, Kansas, and Nebraska have added spring hunts. During our month, the last of the winter snow disappeared, and spiky coltsfoot flowers popped up from the tundra. Labrador tea and other tundra shrubs also flowered. The weather warmed enough that we even got hot on our tramps home to the station. Along with this heat, the mosquitoes hatched, and on a windy day there would be a solid cloud following us, using our bodies as windbreaks. On days with no wind, we suffered and covered up with long sleeves and bug spray. Before we knew it, the summer solstice was past, and with it, the days were so long we had to put cardboard over the hut windows so we could sleep in the 24-hour daylight. Just as we mastered the navigation and bird identification, it was time for us to leave, and the tundra buggy came chugging over the horizon with supplies for those staying on for the entire summer. We packed up and left with mixed feelings. We had learned to love the bleak landscape and calls of the geese all around us, but we would not miss the summer's slew of biting insects. When we got to Churchill, it seemed a veritable metropolis, noisy and crowded. We turned our minds to the next leg of our journey, which would traverse the Yukon, Alaska, New Zealand, Australia, Thailand, and Bali. Those adventures are for another time and place, but took us through the summer and fall. And now Wilson takes us to the month of November. They're in Nepal. This is called A View from the Top. Our time in Nepal started with several days in the capital, Kathmandu, which is a perfect place to understand the true meaning of culture shock. One day shortly after we arrived in the city, I was sitting on a busy downtown street corner taking a break from our trip preparations, drinking a cup of coffee. I could hear Bob Dylan's tune, Tangled Up in Blue, drifting out of a nearby cafe. As I watched, a Rolls Royce drove by, and a minute later I heard a herd of cows coming down the middle of the street. The bovines took a leisurely stroll past me, and one of them defecated on the street. That cow pie had barely hit the pavement when an old woman ran out into the street and gathered it up in her bare hands. As I watched in puzzlement, she reared back like a baseball pitcher and heaved it onto the side of a nearby building. It was then that I realized that the brown circles on that wall were not decorations, but cow pies in various stages of drying. As the pies dried, they fell from the wall, and the old woman would use them as stove fuel to cook her supper. Within the span of an hour, I was approached by prostitutes, begging lepers, and a legless man on a cart with chair rollers who wanted to sell me street food. Kathmandu was a far cry from Mercer, Wisconsin. We got our biological work in Nepal through a connection of Terry's. In 1982, she worked on a project in the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore looking for ways to reduce conflicts between birds and commercial fishermen. The double-crested cormorant was a state-listed threatened species at the time, but their numbers were growing, and they had taken to foraging inside the commercial fishermen's pond nets. These nets were a clever trap for fish with an underwater fence that led fish to a bowl-shaped net pot, where they would mill around until the fishermen arrived to lift the net. The problem was that the pot was held in place by wooden poles that provided a perfect perch for cormorants to roost and dry their wings. Of course, the cormorants also saw the fish in the pot, an irresistible temptation for any fish-eating bird, so they would dive in and forage, damaging a lot of fish they didn't even eat. Needless to say, the fishermen were not happy. The lead biologist on the project was a woman named Esther Lev, and after the cormorant work was done, her adventurous career had taken her to India, Nepal, and Thailand, where she studied birds and led tour groups. When Esther heard that Terry was traveling the world and looking for some wildlife experience, she suggested Nepal, where her good friend Hem Sagar Baral was one of the leading ornithologists. We were lucky to find him in Kathmandu, as he worked for an ecotourism company and was often gone on tours. He had just returned from fieldwork in Langtang National Park, high in the Himalaya Mountains, and was soon to depart for the Netherlands. We met him for dinner, and after some discussion, he said he would put us to work. He was studying forktails, a group of small thrush-like birds that inhabit stream and river valleys in the mountains. He was working with a man named Sebastian Buckton, a research assistant at the University of Wales in the United Kingdom, who was studying biological diversity of river birds in Nepal. Sebastian was in the field, and Hem suggested we might be able to find him on our trek and assist with mist netting. There was one problem, Hem said. Sebastian is still up there in Langtang, completing the winter survey work, and we don't have communication. There's no sure way to find him. I expect he might be along the main trail between our study locations, but Langtang is a big place. We thought it over. What the heck? We were here, and even if we didn't find him, we had been thinking about hiking the Langtang trekking route anyway. It was less touristy, and Esther had told Terry it was beautiful. The next day, Hem handed us maps and a sealed envelope to give Seb if we found him. Before we parted, I asked, "By the way, what does Sebastian look like?" "Oh, you'll know him if you find him," Hem said. "He's British, blonde, and tall. Don't forget to give him my letter." We left the next day on foot, taking it slow the first few days to adjust to the altitude. At higher elevations, the air thinned and oxygen decreased, causing a few headaches. But we trekked on, navigating the winding, rocky trails. After a day or two, the headaches went away, along with the sore muscles from our heavy packs. One day, we saw a Himalayan black bear across a valley. As we continued, we saw several species of monkeys and even a red panda, which ran across a mountainside within view and disappeared into the high forest. There were other travelers from around the world who shared our simple tea house meals and rustic lodging, hosted each night by different Nepalese families. One day, after about a week in the mountains, we were walking up a steep stretch of trail and rounding a bend when we saw a couple of porters, followed by a guy in a khaki shirt and trousers. He had blonde curly hair and a mustache, looked about 30 years old and very British. The real clincher was that he wore a pair of expensive-looking binoculars around his neck. The scene reminded me of what it must have been like in Africa when Stanley met Livingston. We approached and asked, "Are you by any chance Sebastian Buckton?" He looked at us with surprise and then in a strong British accent replied, "As a matter of fact, I am." We handed him our letter of introduction, a bit worse for wear after a week in my backpack. Seb opened the letter and carefully read it. He then slowly looked up, smiling, and said, "Welcome. Fall in line. We'll be stopping for the night at a tea house about 2 kilometers from here." We went to work for Sebastian mist netting and banding Himalayan river birds. A mist net is a fine mesh nylon net stretched between 2 tall poles, like a fence. When set up, the net is nearly invisible. Unsuspecting birds that fly into it become tangled in its pockets, allowing a researcher to safely extract them for banding. Sometimes a couple of us would run the nets and the other two would go upstream and try to herd birds down to the net. We worked locations at different elevations, starting at dawn each day. We caught spotted and slaty-backed forktails, brown dippers, river chats, and plumbeous water redstarts. These cold, cascading streams were misty and cool. The birds were secretive, flitting downstream in the mist. Eventually, we worked our way down the mountains and back to Kathmandu. Had we skipped this research work, we would never have experienced the magic of these valleys in the early morning light. The scientific work made us slow down, pay attention to details, and appreciate the complexity of the river systems. And of course, the dominating presence of the snow-capped mountain peaks rising around us. Culturally and scientifically, Nepal was one of the highlights of our trip. I can still picture one small white stupa, a form of Buddhist monument that stood high on a mountainside. We had hiked toward it for a couple of hours, and when the switchback trail finally approached, we could see a calm statue of Buddha sitting inside. There were prayer flags flying from its pinnacle, and it was surrounded by snow. Everything was quiet and beautiful, and it seemed like a sacred place. That stupa made a very strong impression on Terry, and she later made a large oil painting of that mountain view, showing herself on the trail below, dwarfed by the calm panorama. Nepal taught us much more than what birds live in river valleys. It was a bit of a pilgrimage, testing our strength and showing us the grace and kindness of the Nepalese people. And I'll stop there. I've been reading segments of the book Wrong Tree by Jeff Wilson. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.